This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who are willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And it's important that we preserve their stories for future use, for people that weren't alive during World War II to understand what happened way back when they weren't called the greatest generation just yet. We want to honor our veterans, preserve those stories, and along the way, be educated and sometimes even inspired by these stories. We're going to get a good one today from a guy that one of our listeners, Terry Baker, knows as Uncle Bill, but if you look him up in the phone book, it says George Dubois. So explain that one to me. Are you George or Bill, and does it depend who we ask?
Yeah, I was named George William Dubois, and I had an uncle named George. So rather than Big George and Little George, they decided to call me William, which got into the Bill part. So I went all through the family there up until high school as Bill. But it's actually been George W. Dubois.
Got it. And growing up outside of Visalia, California, very rural area, you raised on a farm?
Yeah, my dad was with Associated Oil Company, which most people have never heard of. But in those days, it was an up-and-coming Tidewater Associated Oil Company. So they moved him around a lot. So we were in Petaluma and then moved from Petaluma down to Visalia. And then from Visalia, my dad bought a little 30-acre ranch out by Ivanhoe. I helped my uncle build a house there on that land. So we went all through high school living there in Ivanhoe. I went to Visalia Union High School, which was the only high school in Visalia at that time. But it was a big school. We had 1,500 kids. And it was a nice time to live there. And so then, out of high school, I graduated and then went one semester to Visalia Junior College. And then I got drafted in early 1943. Went to Monterey, Presidio Monterey there.
Never thinking that you were going to live in Carmel these last 30 years. And something happened your senior year of high school there at Visalia High School that everyone who I've talked to seems to remember where they were and how they found out. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day and where you were and how you heard about the big news?
Oh, yeah. We heard about that. And then, we're going to war. And I thought, oh, well, I might be able to see other parts of the country. I'd never been out of California in my life. And I thought, oh, that might be kind of exciting to go into the Army or Navy or something. But that's about as far as I thought.
Was that something where they called the whole school in to listen to the president on the radio or anything? Do you have any vivid memories of what it felt like in that locale at that time?
No, we heard it on our radio. And then when we would go to the moving pictures, they would have the movie tone news. Remember that? And so we could see Roosevelt saying the day would live in infamy and like that. But we were still just, 17 at that time.
And anyone who lives in Visalia now maybe doesn't realize this, but during World War II, there was an Army Air Corps base there, and there were some pilots training there. There were some young kids from the town who were working out on those runways, starting engines and cleaning planes. Do you remember those planes flying around?
Yeah, I remember that. And my brother-in-law, Bud French, was an instructor out there at Sequoia Field. Out on the farm, we could be working pruning or whatever, and you could look up and you see the Ryans and the Stearman would flying over the countryside there doing their aerobatics and whatnot. So that was kind of interesting.
Did you say see the Ryans or hear the Ryans? Because they have a pretty unique sound, don't they?
The Stearman had the radial engine. And then the little Ryan had a different kind of engine. But we could see him flying around. And I thought, boy, I'd like to go and be in the Air Corps. I would love to fly. But my dad says, oh, you don't want to join the Air Corps. You'll probably never get drafted anyway, being on a farm and all. And so I didn't get a chance to go in the Air Corps. And so then I got drafted and went into the anti-aircraft artillery down by Riverside, Camp Hahn.
At this point, you know, you've graduated from high school, you got a semester of junior college in, and then you're drafted. Had you met a special someone by that point? Was there someone in particular that you might have had your eye on?
No, I knew Judy, of course. She was in high school, but she was just a freshman when I was a senior. And so I didn't think much about that. So I just went into the Army with no ties at all to anybody.
The news of Pearl Harbor and the immediate aftermath, did you sense a change in Visalia, that the attitudes or the energy? You know, I've talked to a lot of folks from that area who had Japanese-American friends who all of a sudden they didn't see around school anymore. Did you have some experiences like that?
Yeah, we had Japanese friends that were in high school there, but it didn't seem like there was a lot of animosity toward the Japanese, because we knew them and they were nice guys. And there wasn't any of that racial prejudice or anything going on at that time. Gee, they all went into the service in that 442nd Infantry Division. And but we did know that they sent their parents to those concentration camps, or, well, I guess you wouldn't call them concentration camps, but they were camps anyway. And we thought that was really unfair because, gee, they were good citizens. And they've been there for a generation or two, and then they sent them to these camps all over. So we didn't like that part of it, but we didn't have much time to think about it the first thing, and I was in the Army.
And you mentioned the anti-aircraft artillery. What were the weapons that you learned to use, and how did you take to that?
Our guns were the 90-millimeter guns. Of course, I grew up on a farm with rifles since I was about 10 years old, so that was nothing new to me. The old M1 Garand was a wonderful rifle.
And what was your role on the crew for those 90 millimeters?
My job as a private, I pulled the lanyard when they said fire, and then opened the breech block when the gun went off. In those days, it was before radar, and so they had optical height finders, and it was about 10 feet long and weighed a ton. Took about six guys to carry it around. They put it on a tripod. You looked in there and you could see the aircraft going by. And if you dial it in just right, they could tell how far away you were. That was a distance. But I was one of the very few that had eyesight good enough to run that height finder, because you had to have stereoscopic vision, which I had. But there was only three or four of us in the whole company that would qualify for that. They said, boy, you're all set to go to height finder school. But then instead of that, I went to Indiana University as an engineering student. So that was the end of the anti-aircraft part of it.
So this was part of a special training program. They had a lot of these at the time that said, we're going to send you to college, you're going to get more education, and we're going to train you for this important role in the war. But a lot of those training programs didn't last that long because they realized, hey, we need some more bodies overseas. What was your experience with that?
Well, you're absolutely right. Gosh, I went back there on the train, and on the way back to Indiana, three guys died on the train from polio. So when we got to Indiana University, they put us out in the stadium in tents as quarantine for about a month. It kind of got to where there wasn't any more cases showing up, and then we went to the regular classes there. They put us up in the dormitories there at Indiana University, and gee, they were beautiful big stone buildings, and we had a lot of fun there, actually. But it was an accelerated program. We just didn't really learn that much. They just shut it off after one semester, and that's when I went to that 20th Armored Division.
So they assigned you to the 20th Armored Division, and you're training down in Kentucky, and you're probably thinking, hey, I'm going to head overseas pretty soon, right?
Probably, yeah. We're training, and we should be, it was a good 20th Armored Division, but gee, there was a lot of older guys that were draftees. They were in there 28, 30 years old. And I thought, geez, these old guys, holy mackerel, I was only 18. And so I thought, I don't really want to go overseas with these guys. And that's when I volunteered for the paratroopers.
Yeah, tell me about that, because I've had literally hundreds of veterans tell me, first rule of being in the military is you never volunteer for anything. And you volunteered for something that I think most people would consider very, very dangerous. What was it that made you decide, yeah, whatever this flyer I'm looking at, that sounds like a good adventure?
Well, yeah, I thought, well, gee, I'm going to go and help win the war. So I couldn't think of a better unit to be in combat with than the paratroopers, and I would rather jump onto land than I would go in on a invasion boat or something like that. The guys that were in the unit are real first-class guys. I really had a lot of respect for the other. There weren't any 30-year-old guys in the paratroopers, I'll guarantee you. Even the officers were young guys.
Let me ask you another question there before we get into the paratrooper things, and maybe this is one you really can't answer, but it certainly seems relevant as I think about it. In all those years since, you know what you did and the choices you made and where you ended up, but have you ever wondered, what if I didn't volunteer for the paratroopers? Do you think you would have gone to Europe with the 20th Armored Division, or what do you think would have happened?
Yeah, I probably would have. They did finally go to Europe, the 20th Armored. And gee, my experience was that I just couldn't get any action no matter what I did, because when I went to the parachute school, and by the way, it was kind of interesting. When you go to the parachute school, they teach you how to pack your own parachute. And you jump your own parachute for the first 5 days. So you never saw a more interested pupil in the world than the guys who was trying to learn how to pack a parachute, because you're going to be jumping that thing.
What did it feel like the first time with that parachute that you packed yourself that you jumped out of one of those planes?
You have to have faith in your equipment. And you knew you packed it right. And you had your straps all buckled and everything was just right. And that's what I just had faith in my equipment. But I did have, not in the parachute school, but later, there was one guy next to me here, and we would go out the door in the same order all the time. And he told me, he says, you know, when I get close to the door there, I just can't move. I just freeze. So push me out. So I did. And we had the big reserve chute on the front of us here. So I just hit him with that reserve and just push him out the door. And then I went out and everything is fine. And the next time, same thing. And I think, you know, that takes a lot of courage when you're so scared that you can't move, but you go anyway. He had a tremendous amount of courage. I did have guys in the airplane there that would be going along, and all of a sudden they would take off their helmet, throw it on the ground and say, that's it, I quit. And they wouldn't jump. So, of course, when they got back on the ground where they were shipped out. Oh, I got to tell you the one thing. So we made a demonstration jump. I think it maybe was in Florida or somewhere. And I was just a private at that time. And so I was on the ground and I was going toward the assembly point. And here's a helmet laying there on the ground. I picked it up and there's a gold leaf on the front of it. It was the major's helmet. And so I took that off and put it on and walked over to some guys who were bending over putting a machine gun together. And I said, okay, you guys, snap it up. We haven't got all day. And one guy stood up and he didn't have a helmet on. It was the major. So I gave him his helmet and that was the end of that little fiasco. But yeah, the guy was one of those that unhooked his chin straps. And you know, you see on television, these guys never have their straps hooked. They're always hanging out because that looks cute. Well, that doesn't work when you jump out of an airplane. You don't have your chin strap. That helmet's gone. And so that's what happened there.
So you suffered no punishment at the hands of the major?
No, there was no punishment there. It was just kind of a joke.
And I think another thing that's important to note, because today the idea of a paratrooper is, you know, it's pretty ubiquitous. I think everyone's familiar with the idea, but in the 1940s, this wasn't something that you had grown up with. I mean, it wasn't something that had really happened before World War II. So what all did you understand about what you might be asked to do if indeed you were deployed in one of these airborne units?
Well, I just thought that I want to be with the best guys. And boy, if I'm going to go into combat, I want to have some buddies that are not going to turn and run or go behind a rock or something. And I just thought, well, that's the best way to get there is in a parachute. And you fly over the trenches and all that kind of stuff, and you would be landing kind of on your own mostly behind lines or something, and but you're with the best guys, and they were a bunch of really good guys.
Yeah, I'm listening to you describe that, and you thought that was the best situation for you. But I've talked to these guys who made these jumps on D-Day and Market Garden and Southern France and all these places, and they'd had no clue where they were. It was dark. They were behind enemy lines, so they didn't know where the enemy was. You thought that sounded like fun?
Fortunately, or may say unfortunately for me, I wanted to help win the war.
So you were willing to do whatever it took, but your story took some unexpected turns. We need to catch a break. George Dubois of Carmel, California is our guest today. More of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.